As you're passing the worksheets around this morning, let me make a musical confession. I like country music. I like it a lot, and I've always liked country music. And I think the reasons why I like country music is because country music has simple tunes, clever lyrics, and good stories. When George Strait sings, "All My Exes Live in Texas," you know the guy's a scoundrel, right? When Johnny Paycheck sings, "Take this job and shove it," you know he's got some problems with management where he works. When Alan Jackson and Jimmy Buffett sing, "It's 5 o'clock somewhere," you know that they have something other than work on their minds at the time. And even when pop singers like Neil Diamond make fun of country music by writing country songs that poke fun at country music, even the country music songs they write turn out to be pretty good country songs. For example, Neil Diamond wrote this song. These are just some of the lyrics. "You're so sweet, you got horse flies hanging around your face. Kentucky moonshine could never take your place. And your eyes could give me goosebumps down to my toes. Feel like the only rooster in a hen house, I guess it shows. Mary Lou Jane, what a fine name. And you're nothing like them girls in New York City. Front teeth missing? Well, that's fine for kissing. You're more loyal than my dog Sam, and twice as pretty." Well, what does country music have to do with Isaiah chapter 5, for crying out loud? Well, actually, you'll find in Scripture that there are lots of songs in the Bible. In Exodus, there is the song of Moses that they sang after God delivered them from Egyptian bondage. There's a fairly erotic song in Song of Solomon. In the book of Revelation, there's the new song that believers will sing when they stand around the throne. And so songs are given to us throughout Scripture. And when we get to Isaiah chapter 5, which is the chapter we're on this morning, we'll find that there is a song. And one of the beauties of this song is that, very much like a country song, it has very simple lyrics and a very clear message to us. And so our goal this morning, in the short time that we have together, is to look at the song of the vineyard that Isaiah gives us in chapter 5. And as you'll see on the handout that we'll also send you electronically this afternoon and post on the website, that all of us can understand Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard if we will ask and answer some very simple questions. And so what we're going to do this morning is read together the Song of the Vineyard, and then we'll work through some of the very simple questions about the Song of the Vineyard that will help us understand the relevance, not only to the people in Isaiah's day who initially heard this, but to others throughout the Old Testament era, and it speaks in a very relevant way to the church today. So let's go to Isaiah chapter 5. And while we will be looking at verses throughout the entire chapter, which is 30 verses long, our primary focus this morning will be on the first 7 verses. So as I read through the first 7 verses, and as we read through those together, begin to think about the questions that we have posed on the worksheet, and then we'll answer those together in just a minute. Isaiah chapter 5, starting in verse 1, Isaiah says, "I will sing about the one I love," that's God, "a song about my loved one's vineyard. The one I love had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He broke up the soil, cleared it of stones, and planted it with the finest vines. He built a tower in the middle of it and even hewed out a wine press there. He expected it to yield good grapes, but it yielded worthless grapes. So now, residents of Jerusalem and men of Judah, please judge between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done for my vineyard than I did? Why, When I expected a yield of good grapes, did it yield worthless grapes? Now I will tell you what I am about to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will tear down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland. It will not be pruned or weeded. Thorns and briars will grow up. I will also give orders to the clouds that rain should not fall on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah, the plant he delighted in. He looked for justice, but saw injustice, for righteousness, but heard cries of wretchedness. Okay, let's see if we can better understand this Song of the Vineyard, and let's work through the worksheet together, at least as much as we can get through this morning. Question number one, who or what is the vineyard? Verse 7 has the answer to that. Okay, the house of Israel, it says in verse 7, and the men of Judah. Now remember that Isaiah was a prophet primarily to Judah, the southern kingdom. But also in his prophecies, he often includes the northern kingdom as well. So all of Israel. And this prophecy is given before the Assyrians take the northern tribes captive. And it happens more than 100 years before the Babylonians come in and take the southern kingdom captive. And so this is, in a greater sense, a message to all of Israel, even though Isaiah prophesied primarily to the people of the southern kingdom, to Judah. So that first question is very clear, that the vineyard being spoken of here is the nation of Israel. And if you'll recall from our study of the parables of Jesus on the kingdom, Jesus actually told about five parables that make mention of the vineyard. And I've listed those on the second page of the handout, on the back side of that one sheet. We won't have time to look at any of those this morning, but I'd certainly encourage you, as you have time, if you want to dig deeper and see how that imagery of the vineyard was for Israel in that day. Jesus makes parables that make reference to Israel in his day as the vineyard, but also the kingdom of heaven is at times seen as a vineyard as well. Okay, question number two, who is the vineyard owner? Okay, God is very clearly laid out here as the vineyard owner. Verses 1, 3, 4, 5, and 7 all make reference to the Lord of hosts as the vineyard owner. And then when God himself is speaking, he refers to it as my vineyard. Israel was God's prized possession. He called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees through no goodness of his own, but through the goodness of God alone. He chose him. He said, through you, I'm going to raise up a great people. They will be as numberless as the sands of the sea and the stars in the heavens. I'm going to give you land. And through you, I'm going to bless all the nations of the world. And that is because through the lineage of Abraham came the Messiah, Jesus Christ. So here we have the vineyard, which is Israel. The owner of the vineyard clearly is God. Now, question three, how has God cared for the vineyard? What did God do for the nation of Israel? And he puts that in the context of the song here. Israel is seen as a vineyard. So look in verses 1 and 2, and let's see what God does for the vineyard itself. What does it say he did? Okay, the end of verse 1, it says he planted it on a very fertile hill. Many crops grow better on a flat surface, but in Israel and other places where wine and grape growing was prevalent, they often took hillsides and planted vineyards there. Vineyards would do okay on a sloped surface. But not only did God choose for them a land, Israel, a sloped land, but it also had fertile soil. So it not only had a geography that would work well for growing wine, but even the soil itself was very fertile. So God gave Israel, God gave the vineyard here a very fertile soil in which to grow. Now, starting in verse 2, what else did he do? Okay, he broke up the soil. Obviously, he had to till the land, and on hillsides in that part of the world, often was very rocky, And so in addition to tilling or breaking up the soil, he took the rocks or the stones and removed them. And so cleared them out so there's fertile soil on a sloped surface with the rocks and the stones removed. Okay, what else does he do in verse 2? All right, he fenced it. There's reference here to a fence and a wall. And many times what would happen is in the rocky soil, they would clear the vineyard of all of the rocks and the stones, and they would use those rocks or stones to build a wall of protection around the vineyard. And then because that countryside often had briars and thorns and thistles and cactus-type plants and that sort of thing, they would clear those out, and they would often put those on the top of the wall itself. So if you can picture a stone wall with barbed wire fence on top of it, that was basically the purpose. It kept predators out, it kept wild animals out, and it kept thieves out, or at least deterred them from coming in. So he cleared it of stones, and then he used those stones to build a wall, and then he cleared the briars off and put those on top so that there was protection of the vineyard itself. All right, what else did God do for the vineyard? Okay, he planted it with the choicest vines. There are, you know, places in the world, in California, France, and other places that are well known for their wine, for their wines and for their vineyards. Some are just better than others, partly because of the soil and partly because of the way they have bred the vine itself. And so a very precious vine will produce very good grapes. And so God took the very, very best and planted it there. And then he built a tower. And oftentimes the tower was either made out of wood or made out of stone. And it was a place that provided shade or shelter for either the owner or for the tenant who watched over the vineyard. So there was a place out of the hot sun. There was a place out of the rain. It would be a place to live during the grape growing season. And these towers would typically be anywhere from 15 feet to 50 feet high. And so it gave either the owner or the tenant who had responsibility for the vineyard a good vantage point to watch for robbers or for wild animals to come through. And also probably a good place to sling a rock or fire an arrow at them if they were under siege by robbers or by wild animals. Okay? And then it says at the end of verse 2, he hewed out a wine press there. So typically what a vineyard owner would do is find a place where there was a large rock or an outcropping of rock out of the earth, and they would cut down into that rock a vat, and it had two levels. The top level is where they would bring the grapes, they'd harvest the grapes, put them in there, and people would literally barefooted stomp the grapes. And then there would be a channel that would come out of there and fall down to a lower place cut out of rock where the juice or the fresh grape juice would fall. Then when it was fermented, they would put it into wineskins. And so there was great expectation on the part of the owner that this was going to produce a great crop because he created a wine press for it. So verses 1 and 2 tell us in a graphic way how the vineyard owner did everything necessary for a great production of grapes. And in terms of that being symbolic of what God did for Israel, God blessed Israel greatly. He gave them people. He gave them a land. He gave them prophets. He gave them kings. He gave them the law. And he gave them his own presence in the tabernacle and in the temple with the Shekinah glory. So God blessed Israel with many, many things. And if you jump forward to Romans 9, which we won't do this morning, but you can read at the end of Romans 9 where Paul reminds the Jews of all of the advantages God gave the Jewish people, that above all peoples of the earth, they were blessed and should know better than anyone else the goodness and the grace and the mercy and the power and the sovereignty of God. Okay, question number 4, since God did everything necessary in planting the vineyard, what were God's expectations of the vineyard? Yeah, verses 2 and 4 says he expected it to yield good grapes. And then jump to verse 7, because we'll see what that means in God's expectation of Israel. At the end of verse 7, look at the last half of verse 7. What were God's expectations for Israel? Okay, he looked for justice and he looked for righteousness. So just as a vineyard owner would expect a good crop of grapes, God expected justice and righteousness from Judah. Okay? Now, question 5, but what did the vineyard produce? Okay, again, verses 2 and 4 tell us they yielded worthless grapes. Does anyone's translation say anything different? Wild grapes or bad fruit. There's a difference between wild grapes, which are not really all that edible or all that suitable. Bitter. The difference between that and the good grapes. So the expectation was good grapes, sweet and juicy and abundant. And what they got were wild grapes. Bitter, small, and not really made for the purpose for which they were grown. And then in verse 7... gives us, at the end of verse 7, tells us what God found in Israel. He expected justice, but he found instead
bloodshed.
Okay? Injustice, what does yours say?
Oppression.
Violence, bloodshed, oppression, injustice. And then he expected righteousness, but he heard cries of wretchedness. What does your translation say? Distress, weeping. Okay. All right. So God's expectation in giving Israel all of the best that he had, what Israel gave back to him was injustice and wretchedness. So we're going to move very quickly now, but let's look at the bottom of page 1 and then the back side of the handout. There are two categories of sin here that God spells out in the second half of Isaiah 5. There are sins of injustice and there are sins of wretchedness. And our translations, you can typically see where those are because Isaiah pronounces woes. Starting in verse 8 is a woe. Verse 11 is a woe. Verse 18 is a woe. Verse 20 is a woe. Verse 21 is a woe. Verse 22 is a woe. And so those are 6 different woes describing 6 different sins under the two categories. First, the category of injustice, and secondly, wretchedness. And so as we look at those, think also about the church today. A comparison of the vineyard to Israel would be more comparable to the vineyard and the church today. It could be a message for a nation as well, but for our purposes as New Testament believers, a better application would be, how does Christ see the church today? And as we look at the 6 different woes, the 6 different sins, I put down here on the board some categories of the church, and let's see as we go through those if we can match them up. We're looking at, there's the carnal church, the postmodern church, the rock star church, the politically correct church, the obstinate church, and the greedy church. Let's see if we can match those up as we look at God's message to Israel. So let's start in verse 8. And it says, "Woe unto those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, and you alone are left in the land." What kind of sin is that a description of here? Certainly injustice, but anything specific that maybe comes to mind for Israel? Okay. Certainly greedy, and the parallel to us today would be the greedy church. Specifically, what Isaiah is referencing here is that every 50th year was a year of Jubilee. If you purchased land, or if someone gave you land to pay off a debt, you kept it until the 50th year, the year of Jubilee. And the value of that land was pinned on the 50th year. In other words, if I bought land in the 49th year, I would pay much less for it than if I bought it in the first year, because on the 50th year, I had to give it back. And that was God's way of providing for the 12 tribes. And so land ownership, which was an important part of being a Jew, would not be kept or hoarded. But what was happening in Isaiah's day was people were buying or taking land because someone owed them debt, and they were not giving it back at Jubilee. And so people were becoming wealthy land barons and being unjust in that. And so that was the primary purpose there. And I know we don't have too much time, but we can think about ways in which the church today perhaps many times operates by worldly principles and is judged by how big the church is, how big their budget is, how many programs they have, how much money they have to spend, what they do. None of those things in and of themselves are ungodly or wrong. But if the focus is on drawing attention to the church because of its size, its power, or its prominence, that's the same thing as violating the year of Jubilee, be the greedy church. Okay, verse 23. We're jumping ahead to verse 23 because that is the second woe of that falls under injustice. Verse 23 says, "They who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of justice." Okay? What would that describe, for example, in terms of the church today? In Isaiah's day, here were people taking bribes. When the just would come, whether it was over a land issue or something else, they were not having justice that was done. And so that could be, actually this one's a little tougher. I would call this the rock star church. The rock star church, because what we have is we have a cult of personality. A church that's driven strongly by a personality or a group of persons who run the church. There was a great article in the Tennessean this week about a church here in town. If I mentioned their name, you would know them. About a year ago, they fired their pastor, and their attendance immediately was cut in half. It was a church that was very much based on the personality who was the pastor, who ran the church. There became lots of issues. He was fired. And the article was great because it talked about how the church had re-identified itself as being a church that was more congregational, that was more focused on being giving and serving in the community, and was no longer a cult of personality. It was no longer a rock star church. It was now a church that more specifically fit the New Testament model. Okay, let's look at the third one, second side of the handout, verses 11 and 12. "Woe unto those who rise early in the morning in pursuit of strong drink, who linger in the evening inflamed by wine. At their feasts they have the lyre, harp, tambourine, flute, and wine. They do not perceive the Lord's actions, and they do not see the work of his hands." Here, of course, talking about drunkenness, starting to drink early in the day, which, while having wine was socially acceptable, starting early in the day, especially drunkenness early in the day, was especially bad. And that's why when Peter got up on the day of Pentecost and all of these 120 were speaking in known human languages that they had not learned, what'd they accuse him of? Drinking early in the day. You just don't do that. And so anyway, in doing that, they had become dull in their minds toward God to the point where they couldn't hear the voice of God. They couldn't reason out the things of God. So that was the attack on Israel. What type of church do you think that matches up with? Yeah, the carnal church. And certainly Paul, in his letters to the Corinthians and other places, talks about those who are more focused on meeting, having their own personal needs and desires met rather than on the things of God. Verses 18 and 19 says, "Woe unto those who drag wickedness with cords of deceit and pull in sin along with cart ropes, to those who say, 'Let him hurry up and do his work quickly so we can see it. Let the plan of the Holy One take place.'" Basically, their sins were becoming, they were unrepentant in their sins. They became worse and worse, more weighted down in sin. And at the same time, they were saying, because we're God's special people, Why doesn't God just get the judgment he's talking about over with and then bring us to the blessing that he also promised us? If God is really God, we can persist in our sin and God still has to do what he promised us to do. That's basically what they were saying here, and that's what God called them to. So, which church would that match up with on the board here? Yeah, probably the obstinate church here. A church that would very much perhaps believe in the security of the believer, eternal security, and say, it doesn't matter how I live, what I think, or what I do, God's got to save me anyway. God's got to fulfill all his promises to me. So I'm going to live the way I want. God has to fulfill his promises. Okay, verse 20. We have two more. Verse 20 says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, and who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Yeah, this is going to be the egalitarian church or the politically correct church. And I say egalitarian, and that is where there is no distinction where God places distinction. An example of that would be churches that ordain females to the pastorate. I don't want to offend anybody, but God's word says what it says, and God means what he says. There are two offices in the New Testament church, pastor and deacon, and God specifically gave those to men. Also, there are churches that ordain and welcome homosexuals into the ministry. Bible says that's a sin. I don't apologize for what God says. He says what he says, and he means what he says, but there are many, many churches today that violate those principles, and they are politically correct, but they're biblically wrong. Okay, last one is verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own opinion and clever in their own sight. That's a clear picture of the arrogance that the Jewish people, and particularly the Jewish leaders, had gotten to, where I believe what I believe, I know what God says, but I know better than God. That would be the postmodern church. Okay, by the postmodern, we simply mean that we've moved as a culture beyond the point where there's an absolute set of right and wrong. That there is no divine being or force outside of us that sets an absolute standard for what's right and wrong. Rather, what I think, what I feel is right, and truth and falsehood are relative. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on the culture. It depends on the time. The postmodern church would be a good example for that. So, we need to wrap up. I know we move very, very quickly through these. There are some other things that you can certainly work through on the second half of the worksheet. But basically, as you look through the second half of Isaiah 5, it says what God is going to do to his vineyard. He's going to take down the walls. He's going to allow it to be overrun. He's going to call the clouds not to rain. And this vineyard, which God had planted and built and tended to with every expectation of providing abundant fruit, he's going to abandon. And the way God's going to do that is with the northern kingdom, he's going to allow Assyria to come in and defeat them in war. They're going to be carried off into captivity. 100 years or so after that, God is going to send the Babylonians in. They are going to defeat the southern kingdom and for 70 years carry the citizens of Judah off into captivity in Babylon. God's blessings for a future Israel are still there, but before God will bless them in time and eternity, he's going to chasten and correct and rebuke his own. He's the one who owns the vineyard. He's the one who planted the vineyard. He's the one who tended to the vineyard. And the vineyard is his. And there's no excuse for the vineyard not to produce abundant fruit. And when it doesn't, as the vineyard owner, he has every right to tear it down and start over. And in here, if you jump forward to 70 AD, where Jesus gives other parables about the vineyard, he talks about the tenant farmers of the vineyard, the Jewish religious leaders that had been entrusted for tending the vineyard. And not only did they not tend it well, but when he sent his very son to come and get the portion of the vineyard that was due him, they killed his son. And for that, God was going to judge them. In 70 AD, the temple was destroyed. The Jews were dispersed. God judged his vineyard, and in doing that, he temporarily set aside the national blessings of Israel
and gave those blessings to the church. God is not done with Israel. God's now restored them, 1948, to their homeland. God is going to redeem a remnant of Jewish believers who will receive Christ as Messiah. And God's promises to Israel will yet be fulfilled. But God has also taken the blessings that were, particularly the spiritual blessings once given to Israel, and has given them to the church. And so when we look at the vineyard and what God did to Israel, we need to also be careful of as the church, because God is the vineyard owner of the church. And just as Jesus is the true vine and we're the branches, if we're unfruitful, he takes the pruning hooks and shears and corrects and chastens and rebukes.